Jen Byrne is going to present to us tonight. Jen has been the district manager of the White River Natural Resources Conservation District since 2019. Jen's been all over the country, volunteering and working in over 15 states in the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources Conservation Service to really get a look at the back end of how the sausage is made in the technical service provision and the conservation services around the country. She's got a master's in environmental law and policy from Vermont Law School, a BS in agricultural science, and even though it's a BS, you know, she's serious, from Oregon State University, and an AAS in alternative energy technology from Lansing Community College in Michigan. She says her mission at the district is to help make conservation effective, consistent, and accessible to all farmers and land stewards. So to put her money where her mouth is, the innovations that she's made in the district in the last 5 years include creating farm teams. So pulling together all of the technical service providers and professional assistants into one team where folks are meeting regularly and the left hand knows what the right is doing to really increase the efficiency and effectiveness of those services and make sure that there's a coherent plan. She's grown our White River Conservation District from 2 staff to 12 in the past 5 years. So we're able to step up the amount of technical assistance we're providing to farmers in the district. And we're about to hire 23 more, basically as apprentices for technical service providers over the next year. They're going to be in the Climate Corps and have a paid opportunity to become certified technical service providers. The Climate Corps is something that Jen's identified. It's part of our whole farm force program, but we're working with a national program called the Climate Corps and with AmeriCorps to be able to pay these 20 some odd trainees to become certified technical service providers, be able to write comprehensive conservation plans, get more service out to more farmers and more money out to regenerative agriculture and agroforestry throughout the district. And all these things are things that we're trying to do all of them with an eye towards replicability and seeing if the kinds of innovations that we're making at the White River District are things that can be copied and expanded in other districts in Vermont and around the country and all the 57 states and territories. So it's been pretty exciting for me to come on board and get to do a little bit of logistics work for this district. And I think that's just about it. We'll be releasing this tape and the other tapes on our YouTube file. And you can also find the audio files for all of the Dirt and Democracy sessions on Jen's Broke in Vermont podcast. So stay tuned for these and other valuable insights on Broken Vermont. So without further ado, let's hear from Jen Byrne. Thanks, Jen. You're
Thank
muted,
you. Doc. Thanks so much. Yep. So I'm going to switch over to my slide deck. Thank you all for being here, for watching after the fact. So today I am going to introduce to some and present to others the locally led conservation district infrastructure that actually exists across the United States. It's very underutilized, I would say, and not really understood by many, but this is a critical piece of our infrastructure that still exists from back in the New Deal days. So tonight, I'll be going over, basically, we're going to start with just a foundation and some principles relating to just transition, environmental justice, and civil rights, so that we can kind of get our footing. And I want to see if we can apply them by the end to what the conservation districts have to offer. Talk a little bit about watershed governments, boundaries versus borders, And then we'll go into the legal history of conservation in the United States, the conservation district history and law, put it into the Vermont context of what exists here in Vermont. And then we'll do a dive into the locally led decision-making process that conservation districts chair and lead throughout the country. And then hopefully have a little bit of time for discussion. So let's see here. First, just a grounding so that you know what we're about to get into. What is a conservation district? This is a democratically organized municipality that exists throughout the country. We're technically subdivisions of state government. Some of us are watershed-based, county-based, or otherwise. And the process for establishing districts is defined in state statute, which we're going to go into it. But I just wanted to make sure we're all clear. We're talking about not the zoning form of conservation district, but the actual democratic body conservation districts that are technically municipalities. And this is our beautiful White River. So I wanted to put this up on the screen at the beginning. I'm going to share it again at the end. And this is the strategy framework for a just transition developed by the Our Power campaign, Movement Generation. There are probably people on this call who could talk really in depth about all these things. This is a really rich diagram. But what I'm posing to you all today is that conservation districts can actually fill a really key role here that can do these things of shifting economic control to communities, democratizing wealth in the workplace, advancing ecological restoration, driving racial justice and social equity, relocalizing production and consumption, and even retain and restore cultures and traditions if utilized correctly or robustly. And then I also threw in here this little yellow arrow that was not on the original strategy framework. But when I see this and I see this arrow change the rules and drawing down money and power from an international to national to local level, what we're talking about today is how we change the rules from the local level going up and actually directly influence national law and policy from this ground level democratic unit of the conservation district. So another just sort of founding principles and thoughts to keep in mind throughout. Some of these are three of the 17 principles of environmental justice from the 1991 National People of Colors Conference in DC, where these were established. But three of them, I think, really apply to what we're talking about today and conservation districts in general. One, that environmental justice demands the right to participate as equal partners at every level of decision making, including needs assessment, planning, implementation, enforcement, and evaluation. You'll learn tonight, conservation districts do those really four out of those five. We don't do enforcement, but we definitely do needs assessment, planning, implementation, and evaluation. Environmental justice affirms the fundamental right to political, economic, cultural, and environmental self-determination of all peoples. So having a say-so in how you're being governed. And environmental justice affirms the need for urban and rural ecological policies to clean up and rebuild our cities and rural areas in balance with nature, honoring the cultural integrity of all our communities, and providing fair access for all to the full range of resources. I'll add on to this that Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 dictates that no person in the United States, no person, not resident, not citizen, but person in the United States shall, on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subject to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So what this means is that in order and really in effect, in order to show compliance with the Civil Rights Act, all recipients of even $1 of federal funds must create meaningful community engagement plans and language access plans. And that can be daunting, I think, to many, you know, nonprofits and governmental agencies to learn that fact. But the good news that I'd like to present to you today is that the locally led conservation process that's established by law, rule, and guidance that we're going to go through tonight is a key way that conservation districts and other recipients of federal conservation dollars could show compliance with the civil rights law. And to kind of wrap this all up, what to me all of this means is that for, you know, we don't have equality yet. So what we need to do, what equity to me means, is to put that extra oomph into the way that we get out our resources, the way that we get people to participate in decisions that impact their health and their human environment. And so that's sort of what, you know, the foundation of a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is really based in how we conduct community engagement to make sure that resources are being distributed to folks who need it, and then also that folks are being consulted when policies are written about them. So here's a picture that I love that is of all the watersheds in the world. And I guess I wanted to see if there was any discussion maybe that we could have, especially based on who's here. I feel like there's often talk about why watersheds, otherwise known as catchments or basins, are an interesting way to think about governance, human governance. We're talking about boundaries instead of borders. And conservation districts are essentially watershed governments. Now, the boundaries of every district, you know, is determined by the residents of that district. So not every district is a watershed district, but it could be. Our district is one of these watershed districts. So I guess, are there any thoughts on, I have heard this many times through in our community, folks being really excited about the concept of a watershed government. Does anyone have anything that they want to say in favor of or against? You know, why would a watershed government be something that is, you know, potentially important to how we go about the next 50 years?
Water quality protection and improvement.
Mm-hmm. I would add awareness of our natural circumstances. I have no idea what watershed I'm in, and that strikes me as too bad. Maybe many of us in urban areas, but elsewhere too, are completely ignorant of the way the watershed affects our daily life, or that it, you know, is even an important part of the natural world.
Well, go ahead, Ernest, please.
You must, as environmentalists within our state of Vermont, and I love the White River since I was a kid. It rolls right by the Vermont Law School. And upstream of the White River are beautiful farms. Throughout your work in the future, you must and should include the voices of the people who've been protecting that water throughout its history and its agriculture. You cannot make change that you want to environmentally without including agriculture in your language within the state of Vermont. Farmers and farm workers, especially farm workers, and I'm a white guy, there should be a black guy or a Hispanic guy here, not me, defending our farms and our agriculture. Because our farm workers seem to have gotten stuck in the eclipse that happened this spring, and not having the voices of our farm workers and farmers being heard and rebuilt a language that has grind up and burnt under the Capitol because of 40 years and 50 years of poor leadership and representation. There's no representation of farmers or farm workers in its capital, period. You can't change it until there is. We must have Hispanic farm workers and Black farm workers and farmers at the table every day who are not, and they're being silenced because of the eclipse. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. I think from like a social movement or organizing perspective, the watershed is a really interesting idea because we're always looking for what's the unifying vehicle. How can we help people really identify and make common cause with each other? And when you help people geographically locate themselves in relationship to this primary resource of water and what that does for life in their neighborhood and their conservation district. And
you don't even know their life of the farms or the farm workers.
Hold on, Ernest, we're going to go. Ernest, we're going to go one at a time. Yeah, Henry, and then we're going to go to the next slide.
Yeah. I think you know where I'm going with that, but it just gives people an opportunity to understand themselves, to be in one watershed and start working together to protect the water and the other resources in that watershed, which certainly include each other and must necessarily include the folks that don't have a voice at the table.
Yeah. Thanks. And I would just say from, kind of my point of sharing this, this map is to show, you know, as opposed to like gerrymandered, you know, imaginary lines, these watersheds are real physical boundaries and, and we can actually impact the water quality, the soil health, you know, the biodiversity of these physical regions. And if we work together. And so I'm going to carry on. We're going to go into the history here a little bit, where legally we came from. When I went to law school, I'm not a lawyer, but when I learned about, you know, the history of environmental law, they start in the 70s. It's sort of this idea that all environmental law started in the 70s with the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. This, in my perspective, is not exactly true. There has been soil law for a really long time in our country, and it has a really fascinating history relating to agriculture specifically. So back in 1894, that's when we started this soil survey of the United States through the Division of Soils, which was to investigate, inventory, document, classify, and interpret soils. This is now the National Cooperative Soil Survey. You can find your soil type on Web Soil Survey. If you Google that, you can go on there and find your soils. It's not the easiest tool to use, but you can ask if you need help. And then by 1930, the United States was dealing with the impacts of, you know, ripping up a lot of native grass, planting annual wheat and other crops in the Midwest. And the result was the Dust Bowl, which there's a picture here of this giant, those aren't mountains, that's a dust cloud, where, you know, we just lost millions and millions of tons of soil, which washed across the entire United States. So in 1933, in reaction to this Dust Bowl, the Soil Erosion Service was formed. This was, you know, really to develop demonstration projects in critically eroded areas across the country to try to show landowners the benefits of conservation. By 1935, the Soil Conservation Act, the federal act, established a permanent agency, which was the Soil Conservation Service. This is now the NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, to deal with, quote, the wastage of soil and moisture resources on farm, grazing, and forest lands, naming it a menace to the national welfare. And labor for producing these demonstration projects was provided by the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Civil Works Administration, and the Works Progress Administration. Really, you know, all New Deal programs going through the Depression. By 1937, there was this this standard state soil conservation district law was written. This is what we're going to go into on future slides in depth. So keep that date in mind, 1937, and the state standard soil conservation district law. I'll talk more about that. And then here I provide a few more, you know, key pieces of history of how we get here through conservation. The Watershed Protection and Flood Control Act of 1954, the Soil Bank Program in 1956, which paid producers to retire erodible land, the Resource Conservation and Development Program in 1962, which are these councils that were even larger than a watershed or a conservation district. Those still exist in some form today, but are not as active as they used to be. 1970 gives us the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, which a lot of folks know about because they have to deal with it when, you know, working big projects, which requires federal agencies to evaluate and report on the environmental impacts of their activities. The Rural Development Act established the Natural Resource Inventory. Finally, 1977, we get the Clean Water Act. That same year, 1977, we also got the Soil and Water Resource Conservation Act. And this is the act that essentially created all the programming at USDA for conservation, the NRCS programming. And I like to look at this law and dream of a day when we can go back to kind of the basic fundamental purpose of this law. In this law, the USDA was authorized and directed to develop, quote, in cooperation with and participation by the public through conservation districts, state and national organizations and agencies, a national soil and water conservation program, hereinafter called the program, to be used as a guide in carrying out activities of the Soil Conservation Service, now NRCS, which assists landowners and land users at their request in furthering soil and water conservation on private and non-federal lands of the nation. They then spend the rest of the act talking about a program, which was one program to pay farmers and land stewards to conserve resources on their farm. Now we have many, many, many programs, and I hope one day we can kind of turn this ship around and streamline the way that we pay farmers for all the good things they do. And then, you know, just carrying on, 1985 was the Food Security Act, also known as the Farm Bill, which made conservation compliance a prerequisite for participating in USDA programs. Conservation compliance is probably not what you think. It's really just what is colloquially known as swamp buster and sod buster. So you can't farm on highly erodible land, very steep slopes, you can't, you know, break up a swamp in order to farm. Prior to 1985, it was okay. After 1985, it was not okay. And then in 1994, that's when NRCS got their new name, and they also got the responsibility of the money. So they provided technical and financial assistance since 1994, which was a really big deal and a really big turning point for the agency. You hear about this a lot from the folks who have long memory in the agencies, that it was really when NRCS, quote, got the money, that things turned around and they started to go deeper into contract management. And, you know, that's when, you know, the computer tools started to be very important. So, like I said, we're going to go back to 1935. And we're really going to focus today on this soil conservation district. What I just listed, a bunch of federal laws. But what this is a state law that was actually drafted by the USDA, by the federal government. So it's pretty fascinating history. I don't know of any other story that goes like this. So buckle up. Basically, as early as 1935, these USDA managers began to search for ways to extend conservation assistance to more farmers, and they believed the solution was to establish democratically organized soil conservation districts to lead the conservation planning effort at the local level. I like to quote the USDA website there just to show the, you know, the really the fundamental reasoning why regarding the effective, so the early conservation programs and demonstration projects were seen by farmers to be, you know, just another idea that the federal government came up with and are imposing on them. And so at the time, Hugh Hammond Bennett, who was, you know, a leader in the USDA at that time, he ran a study of farmers to try to understand why weren't they adopting these conservation practices on their farms that they were trying to, you know, establish across the country. And they, you know, it was really the lack of direct involvement of local farmers in these projects. They thought that the projects were too expensive, too time and labor intensive, and too technical for individual farmers to implement themselves. And again, they thought it was just another government program being forced on them without their input. And so, because of those, the results of this, you know, survey and research, Hugh Hammond Bennett and his team felt that the solution was to establish these local units of government that are governed by local land occupiers and farmers with financial and technical support provided by the state and federal government, and that all federal programs should allow local farmers to control the decision making, and the federal government would provide the technical and financial support. And so they authored this law that they then sent out across the country to all the states and territories. And so they really believed that the districts had to be created and run by the people living within its boundaries, or else the concept would never work effectively. And that they also believed that the NRCS should function only through this newly formed conservation district rather than on its own. I would really recommend folks, if they want to learn more, we can share these slides, but this paper was drafted about the conservation district history, and we can share that. It's very, very fascinating. And so what we've got is over 3,000 conservation districts across the country. All 57 U.S. states and territories have adopted some version of this law. There are over 7,000 elected individuals serving on governing boards across the country, 17,000 serving on the governing boards across the country. I, over the past 2 or 3 years, our district with a team, multiple teams of students out of Vermont Law School have compiled all 57 conservation district laws into this database, and broke it up by, organized it by heading, really, to compare it to that original statute. And this is a resource that's available. We're still vetting it for full accuracy before we want to make it too public, but it is available if anyone's interested. Districts, just so that you know, if you live in a state and you're listening to this that's not Vermont, conservation districts go by different names. Some of them are natural resource conservation districts, soil and water conservation districts, resource conservation districts, land conservation departments. Just something to be aware of, that every state is a little different, which makes it, you know, special and unique, but also it, you know, can be challenging to collaborate across state lines because of this fact. So to zoom into Vermont, just to use Vermont as an example, what the Vermont State Soil Conservation Act does is establish the agency that oversees the district. So the State Natural Resource Conservation Council is established in 1939 in Vermont as an agency of the state, each district, the districts were allowed by this law to be formed by the land occupiers within that district. So the districts themselves are individual municipalities, and the council is the overarching body that can oversee and direct money to these districts. Unfortunately, in Vermont, the NRCC doesn't even have a website, so don't look it up. But here's the statute. If you want to learn more, you can look up the Vermont Soil Conservation Act. This is the makeup, the composition of council. And so the folks who sit on council in Vermont. This is different in every state. The director of the state extension service or representative, the secretary of agriculture, food and markets or representatives, the secretary of natural resources or representative, and then one supervisor from each of the conservation district's supervisory unions, of which there are six in Vermont. There are 14 districts in Vermont. There are six supervisory unions. So there are six seats of elected officials that interface with these state agency departments. There are also advisory members that are supposed to serve on NRCC that are listed here, parks and forests and parks, fish and wildlife, the state planning office, which I don't think Vermont has that office anymore, as well as a USDA representative. These are non-voting members. So what's, I think, very interesting and special about the Natural Resource Conservation Council is that it is a place where the executive branch interfaces with a locally elected representative of their community. There aren't many other councils that have elected representatives. Most of the time, representatives on councils are appointed. So to take it even more local, here's a map of our district that I work for, the White River Natural Resource Conservation District here in Vermont. As I mentioned, there's 14 districts. This is a map of all 14 districts throughout Vermont. About half of us are watershed-based, half of us aren't, and are county-based. I also want to share that this little post-it that was on my desk when I took this job, if you're only learning about conservation districts tonight, you're not alone. A lot of people don't know what they are. And there's really they've been very neglected, and there's not a lot of infrastructure that stays with them. So that's why we really cling to this statute that established us, because it proves that we're real. But other than that, when I took my job, the only real, I had maybe 2 days with my the outgoing district manager, which is more than some. And I had this post-it note that was stuck to my desk that says, "The function of the conservation district is to take available technical, financial, and educational resources, whatever their source, and focus or coordinate them so that they meet the needs of the local land user for conservation of soil, water, and related resources." So with that directive, if we go deeper into the statute to ask those questions, like why do we exist? What are our actual powers and duties? So again, there are 14 districts in Vermont. Our district is one municipality within this broader network. And each municipality has five elected supervisors. And so the powers and duties of the conservation district supervisors are as follows. So this is what really directs our work and my work. I'm a staff member. I'm not an elected person. My bosses are the elected representatives. And so here are the things that we can do. We can and do hold public elections for our supervisors. These supervisors must be residents of the district. They do not need to be landowners, according to our statute. We can purchase land and equipment and make the equipment and land available to the community. This can include agricultural and engineering machinery and equipment, fertilizers, seeds, seedlings, and any other such material or equipment. That's from our statute. We can distribute funding and accept funding from any source, public, private. We can carry out conservation measures and demonstrations, including engineering operations, methods of cultivation, growing of vegetation, and changes in use of land. We can promulgate rules, otherwise known as ordinances, just like any municipality, but these rules are specific to land use, erosion control, and natural resources. And finally, we can conduct surveys of natural resources and develop comprehensive plans for the conservation of natural resources. We're going to go into these plans, which I'm going to refer to as local needs assessments and conservation action plans, is a key thing that we're supposed to provide for our community. And on this next slide is really just from our statute in case there's any questions. I think I might pause here if there are any questions about our statute and our purpose, but I did want to put the actual language up here. It is pretty interesting to me. Our law is clearly, when you read it, it's definitely from the 30s. Some of the language is I guess just verbose, but it also has been edited many times throughout the last 85 years. So some of these sentences tend to be run-on sentences. So just if you have trouble reading this law, you're not alone. Are there any questions or comments? Anyone surprised that this governmental structure exists?
Jen, do you have any idea, or can you give us a sense when you're doing your work with the Vermont Law School, how many districts are active as you are? And, you know, is there a movement to build up the use of these districts? How do things kind of stand either statewide or, you know, New England or nationally?
Yeah. Well, yes, there are 3,000 active districts across the country. There's several groups that work to coordinate districts. So there's the National Association of Conservation Districts that is incredibly active. I had the privilege of going to one of their meetings a couple years ago, and it was just astounding how many, you know, there was representatives from every state and staff members from every state. And we all shared this common, like, districts are so important and no one knows about them kind of a feeling. So it definitely felt like, you know, there are a lot of folks who really believe in this infrastructure and want to see it thrive. But I think universally they're not well known. I know, like, Nevada's district slogan is, Nevada's best kept secret. It's the conservation district. So unfortunately we all face this kind of invisibility. In New England, we do have regional, I guess I forget what they call it, but the Northeast Regional kind of Conservation District Association that meets. We're meeting in August in Boston. It's a huge national infrastructure. So I think if you know about them and you're involved in them, then you do, you know, advocate for them and believe in them. But there's, you know, more people who don't know about them than do, I would say. And no, not every district is as active. In Vermont, there's definitely more activation of the districts in recent years. And but, you know, some districts still only have a half-time staff member. And then you have a district that has, you know, our district has more over 10 employees at this point. So it's not equal. And I would say a lot of that comes down to just, you know, states not really recognizing the importance of funding districts and, you know, us having to get creative. So it's really just up to whoever's in my position as a manager to raise all the money. Which is why we really want to educate everyone about this infrastructure, because you can make a lot of change just in your local community, just by knowing about this and kind of, you know, I'll go into sort of ways that we can help, but any other questions?
I just want to add, Jen, I know the National Healthy Soils Coalition is working on some federal policy that would provide state level funding. I don't know if that would be through the conservation districts or not, but I want to follow up and find out about that. That would be interesting to know.
Yeah, here's hoping.
I'm just curious on some of the language in comparison to other similar states, if their language includes farmers and people who grow food in mm-hmm. comparison to other states.
Yep.
Throughout my own research, I can't show you and I can't describe it. And going to the Capitol for several years, I've noticed the trend how farmers and workers and landowners have been, oh, what's the right word? Purposely excluded. And that's similar to farm worker laws that are built in from like the 30s. Farm workers don't get unemployment. Farm workers don't get overtime. So if it's built into Vermont to continually exclude throughout its paperwork, I wonder if all the other states do the same thing, because I doubt that other states would not utilize the funding from the government and send it out directly to the farmers. Does that make sense? When you think about money to change our environment, it starts on the farm. Mm-hmm. So it seems like our dollars went someplace else, not to the farms who are the leaders in climate change throughout the world. Thank you.
So yeah, the only way I can answer it in part by this survey that we ran. And so I'm on the Airtable right now. And this is just like one example of how we can use this Airtable. But I searched it by eligibility to serve on this elected board if farmer is explicitly mentioned. That's not to say that like farmers are excluded from the other states, but these are the states where farmers are explicitly mentioned American Samoa, Delaware, Idaho, New York, Pennsylvania, and Puerto Rico is what we've got here. Interestingly, Puerto Rico and American Samoa, it's the only eligibility factor. And so it completely depends on your state. And you can see each one, using this table, you can actually go in and see the text of the law that sometimes they are saying that you have to have, you know, farmers on your board, and other times, even having some of these have the explicit inclusion of people who aren't farmers on the board. So they're trying to get that diversity of thought. Not sure if that perfectly answers your question.
Did you say Vermont in there when you mentioned Puerto Rico, Somalia? Vermont was in there?
Nope.
Is in there? No, that's what I thought.
It's not explicit to farmers in Vermont. And in fact, Vermont's language is quite, Vermont actually uses the word landowner in terms of eligibility to vote. And not only that, but also in different sections on like who we serve and who gets to lease, you know, equipment from us, it uses the word landowner. Vermont is only one of seven states that use the term landowner. And that is something that I think that having that word in our statute to direct eligibility of voting is very likely unconstitutional and needs to be removed. The original legislation, this is what is really exciting to see, is that the original legislation only used this word right here, land occupier, which I think, you know, is a much better alternative to what we've got. So I'd like to go back to that original language if it were up to me. Okay, I'm gonna go back into our presentation. Where were we? All right. So the next portion of this presentation, I'm gonna talk through our process for community engagement and locally led conservation. This is a really important and exciting, very well-defined process that actually exists through in federal statute, rule, and guidance. The images you see on your screen right now are of our guidance documents that come through the federal government. I always say I would love to meet the person who wrote this and shake their hand. I only got these guidance documents maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and it was so clear. It's laid out so well. So I'm just really, really thrilled that we have this in writing. And so you can see like subpart A, this locally led conservation defined. Locally led conservation consists of a series of phases that involve community stakeholders in natural resource planning, implementation of solutions, and evaluation of results. Locally led conservation begins with the community itself working through the local conservation district. It is based on the principle that community stakeholders are best suited to deal with local resource problems. And then it lays out, I just have a snippet of it, but you know, it lays out the public involvement where the conservation district leads the effort to gather public input from a broad range of agencies, organizations, businesses, and individuals in the local area. These community stakeholders evaluate natural resource conditions in a conservation needs assessment and establishes goals to meet those needs. And then it lays out this conservation action plan where the conservation district involves community stakeholders in developing and agreeing on a conservation action plan. I'm going to go into that on another slide. And then subpart B talks about these local working groups, which this is, Christine, to go back to your question, there is absolutely a national swell of energy behind local working groups. This is a really key way that USDA accepts information from the public. And so USDA and the conservation districts and our other partners have been working nationally to try to uplift this infrastructure. So I'm going to go into that a little bit as well. So the local working groups, these exist across the country. In a lot of states, they may not actually happen. So this is one of these things where if you know about them, you should be asking questions of your local conservation district and your NRCS office to see if they, like, when was the last time they held one of these local working groups? But these are subcommittees of your state technical committee. So the state technical committee convenes either twice a year or four times a year in every state. The USDA comes and listens basically to partners. And so this is where other state agencies and organizations come and provide information, analysis, and recommendations to the USDA. And then, you know, so the local working groups, as I said, are subcommittees of this state technical committee. And the state technical committee must review the activities of the local working groups to ensure the priorities are being addressed locally. Local working groups can directly influence the way that USDA programs function for your community. So that can include the funding prioritization, the actual conservation practice standards, like the way that they write out how to do certain conservation practices, payment rates for practices, as well as ranking questions, which are the key way that money gets out the door. Is, you know, a farmer comes into the USDA office, they sign up for a program, they get a plan written, and then they get ranked. And the being able to influence those ranking questions is actually powerful tool. So here is the composition of the local working groups. This is true across the country. As I said, conservation districts chair their local working group, but if they don't take that responsibility on, then it default goes to the NRCS, which is the federal government. And so we've seen that happen across the country where, because conservation districts don't really know this is their job, and also we definitely don't get funded to do this, it's largely fallen out of the hands of this local unit of government, and it's instead something that the federal government does. The composition of your local working group include agricultural producers that represent the variety of crops and livestock raised within the local area. This is going to that question previously about, like, what about the farmers? This This is so important that agricultural producers from all types of farming in that local area are included on the local working group. Two forest land stewards or non-industrial private forest land owners and stewards are included in the local working group. Conservation district officials, of course, as well as other professionals who are familiar with agriculture and natural resource issues in the local community, including local, state, tribal, and federal government representatives. Here are from our, again, this is actually listed in the Code of Federal Regulations. So this is a rule of the composition of the local working group. Now, within the guidance around the local working group, we're told that local working group representation should be diverse and focus on agricultural interests and natural resource issues existing in the local community. Participation should include individuals from historically underserved groups, including but not limited to women, persons with disabilities, socially disadvantaged, and limited resource groups. To become listed participant of the local working group, individuals or groups should submit a written request to the chairperson detailing their interest for serving on the local working group. I would say that doesn't happen. In general, we hold open meetings and that there isn't like a formal list, but this is the guidance. So I'm just trying to promote, like, let's all follow the rules. So I just want to make sure everybody knows what the rules actually are. So you get together as a group and then what? Local working groups are supposed to do several things, as you saw from those guidance documents. One is conducting a local conservation needs assessment, which is a comprehensive evaluation of the condition of an area's natural resource base. This is resource-based, not program-based. And this also coincides with our state statute that instructs conservation districts to develop surveys of natural resources. So, you know, we're being told from the state and the federal government that this is our job. Then also the Conservation Action Plan, where community stakeholders with the leadership of the district plan for the needed programs and services to address problems identified in their needs assessment. Here are the components of a conservation action plan. We are at the very beginning stages of creating these plans because we really didn't know that this was, we didn't have this guidance prior to a couple years ago, but we're really excited that this is all in writing and has such great, you know, pointers. So we're supposed to identify natural resource conservation priorities, identify federal, state, tribal, local, and non-governmental programs and services needed to address specific conservation needs, set measurable conservation objectives, identify responsibility for action and create a timeline for completion, identify technology needed to achieve the goals, and identify the need to develop new programs or processes to address the problems not covered by existing programs. Our guidance explicitly states that we're supposed to be looking at federal, state, and private programs and basically putting out recommendations for how we want those to work in our community. And then finally, pretty much the most exciting new opportunity that we have going through our local working group are these local funding pools. This is only available in 6 states throughout the country: Hawaii, Minnesota, Montana, Oregon, South Dakota, and Vermont, as far as I know. What this means is the local conservation district, through our, you know, reports and this local work group, we can propose ranking questions priority practices in our community. And so instead of having a farmer go into the USDA, sign up, and be ranked in a pool with all the rest of the state and their competing, you know, natural resource issues, we now can create local funding pools where it's money that will be spent in our community in the next fiscal year by USDA. So this is specifically for EQIP, if you know what that means, Environmental Quality Incentives Program. So it's specifically right now an NRCS focused opportunity. But if you know, with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, NRCS in theory, has quintupled the money to spend over the next like 5 years that they've ever had before. And so this actually is a huge opportunity to leverage and target federal money into communities as small as, you know, a watershed, a town, a neighborhood. As long as we can justify it through our planning process, we can say, you know, in fiscal year 25, we want to spend $500,000 on this set of practices in this community. And we've done that here in Vermont. So this is our third year with local funding pools. And this year we requested $1 million for community scale agriculture and agroforestry practices in our watershed. And I know other districts have done similar local funding pools. Here are just some other things that you can talk about with your local working group, you know, coordinating with other entities, identifying geographic areas of concern, identifying a need for public information and outreach campaigns, providing guidance on conservation practices, including new and innovative practices, things that you wish the USDA paid for. Identifying significant natural resource concerns, make some guidelines for developing new ranking criteria for evaluating applications, identifying and monitoring performance indicators, technical programmatic recommendations, guidance on eligible conservation activities, and evaluating and reporting program impacts on natural resources in the environment. So really, this is such a big task. We have to keep engaging with this from now until forever. This is our job. We have to do it every year. And you can too. You can get involved with your local conservation district and local working group and be a part of setting these priorities and informing these like iterative policy improvements, which is what it's all about. Right here, we have a link to our local work group survey that was developed to be broadly applicable. And I can put the, you know, this link in the chat. It's available on our website. And I think I only have two more slides. This is my last slide, really, where I just want to put out there to you, this is how you can get involved no matter where you live in the United States, in a state or in any of the United States territories. You can participate in your locally led, democratically organized conservation district infrastructure. So go and find and connect with your local district. Ask them about the local working group and join your local working group. It's probably just one meeting a year. Ask about creating local funding pools for your state if you don't have them. Run for your conservation district board of supervisors. That's a great opportunity to be, you know, a public servant. And also I have a link here for our conservation career workforce development program. That's in collaboration with the Virgin Islands. And then also you can tune in to our podcast, Broken Vermont, which goes over a lot of these types of policy and you know, community-led efforts. So yeah, so this is, we're going to land where we started, really. I wanted to put this back up on this page and just kind of hear what you think. Can conservation districts do this just transition where we shift economic control, you know, democratize wealth, advance ecological restoration, drive racial justice and social equity, and relocalize production while retaining and restoring culture and tradition? Now we'll just open it up for discussion. Any thoughts really are welcome.
Thank you for your presentation. You have mentioned a lot of different states and Virgin Islands. I'm familiar with Puerto Rico. And did you mention in there you're from or something Massachusetts? Or something about Massachusetts law? Well, anyways, there's a difference between people who work in agriculture in Vermont and compared to Massachusetts, and Puerto Rico does a great job with its farm bureau, Puerto Rican farm bureau, connecting them with environmental protection agency resources, as well as every USDA resource. You should know USDA has over 20, maybe over 30 different areas they work on, as well as rural development and housing. I talk specifically about the needs of farm worker housing, and in comparison to Hurricane Marie that wiped out a lot of the island, when you look at how they rebuilt in comparison to last year's flooding, in comparison to the funding's requested and who's requested it, then you analogy their history and our history, and then you look at our history over the last several years of differences between Puerto Rico and myself. An organization that I'm a board member of, PASTO, we work in Puerto Rico. So when I know what's going on in Puerto Rico, and I know what's going on in Vermont, why isn't anyone here working? There's no grasp like you want to bring in. There is in Puerto Rico.
Sorry, what was the question? Why isn't anyone what?
There's a big difference in Vermont and Puerto Rico when you look at its history of rising and its leaving out its farmers and farm workers. There's a big difference. There's a big difference how they always recognize agriculture, because without agriculture, very hard for them to feed their island. Okay, we just had pandemic. We just had flooding. So has been historically more resilient in welcoming and open to all races, all people in Vermont and Puerto Rico. And it's sad that our leaders are so divided in not knowing our own history, agriculture across, and Puerto Rico, not even a state.
Yeah, I think that's, Ernest, I think that's a really important comparison that you're making. And I think that one of the interesting things is that even though Puerto Rico is in a state, they still have the Virgin Islands Conservation District. I'm wondering what folks are thinking about in the districts that they live in, whether in in Vermont or not, whether this looks like a practical vehicle to make the kinds of impacts that Jen is describing, and whether or not conservation districts feel like an accessible route to realize some of the objectives you've got in your work.
Julie, go ahead, Julie.
No, we're going to go to Julie. Hang on just a second. Thank you.
I just have a quick question relative to that. So I know our conservation district in Cheshire County, there is a board of directors that govern that. And it's been mostly the same board of directors. It doesn't ever seem to change. And so I just don't, do all boards have the same bylaws that govern, and particularly around positions and seats? Because while it can be an opportunity to elect and have local representation, sometimes I think blocks can be established within that representation. And then if there isn't rules that require board members to attrition off, and it can be hard to make or affect change. And you have the same voices in there. So I didn't know.
You're talking about New Hampshire.
About that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, it's very common that the same, there's not usually any kind of term limit. And I would say in all my time here, we've never had the point of actually an election, because we've never had more than one person run. And so in Vermont, we have to have, you know, they have to go through the collecting the 25 signatures from their community and then submit that to us. And then if we don't get more than one, we don't run an election, they're appointed. So there's always an appointment clause.
Okay.
And yeah, you could, I'm like in the,
I don't even think, I've never even seen anything publicized about those appointments when seats do come up. So that's interesting. I think it's done behind closed doors is the point.
You know what? New Hampshire doesn't have elections. They're all appointments.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
It looks like, so here, I'm just going to share my screen so you can see the data, but yeah, they are appointed by the State Conservation Committee. So look at this. New Hampshire doesn't even have the election process.
That would be why then. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, that's interesting. But you know, then it's like, okay, who's on the committee?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we can go into that if you want to see.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, yeah, this is your committee. So it's kind of circular because it looks like the district supervisors serve on the committee that appoints the district supervisors.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, but you know, that really was our intention for putting this database together. It was actually when I went to this national conference of conservation districts, it was in Puerto Rico, and mm-hmm. It was so clear that this was needed, because there's some things that are great that other states do, and there's some things that other states do that's like, oh, I'm glad we don't do that. So that's what this resource is supposed to be for. Yeah.
Well, maybe we can lift this up as a better model to implement in New Hampshire.
You might need to update your law. That's our hope too, is to put out kind of a new sample state law potentially in the future. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Go ahead. There's
a lot of examples. You know, it seems like New Hampshire is
Christine
maybe.
Had
I'm so sorry. Great.
No, I was on a different topic, so go ahead.
I was just talking about how accessible a conservation district might be to getting more motivated people to help farmers and land stewards in their communities into those positions as the district supervisors and into the staff positions. In some places, less so, but in other places, you know, really good organizing when you know, the status quo doesn't see it coming can end up changing a lot of things really rapidly. That's all I was going to contribute.
Yeah, I was going to ask kind of generally, I think it's really exciting what you've put together here, Jen, and the opportunity for local participation and action that this presents. I'm very struck by the potential and therefore curious about the way you or others are thinking about interacting with a couple of other groups of important sort of players in this space. One is, you know, where I live, it's all seems like the environmental concern and activism is concentrated in NGOs, you know, Mothers Out Front, Green Space Alliance, 350.org, trustees, the Audubon, National Audubon Association. And I'm wondering, do those organizations work with, or are they aware of the potential of actually using and interacting with these vehicles of local governance? And the other group, I mean, the other group that I'm going to go talk to tomorrow are the local government and environmental law people. Obviously, you've been doing it at Vermont Law School, but, you know, we could do it at Harvard and other places. I don't know how aware they are. I suspect they're not aware at all of the potential for this kind of governance infrastructure.
Yeah. Yeah. I've gone through all the phases of grief with this, where it's like, I've been shocked by who doesn't know about it. And now I'm not shocked anymore. Because honestly, even people who work for conservation districts don't know what conservation districts are. People who serve on the boards, on the councils, on the, you know, the federal agencies, it is a lost, not like it's just a lost story, I think. But you know, we have the same problem in Vermont. I would say it's like so many nonprofits that are working in this space that if only, you know, that money could be channeled through this like democratic infrastructure, it would be so much more equitable. And that's basically why we're putting this series on, is to try to get more people to know that. I would say, you know, Michael Fernandez is on the call. We talk about this a lot because we both went to Oregon State University, went online, but
Go Beavers. You
know, Go Beavers. It's like a core, like when you learn about conservation and soil, you learn about the soil conservation districts, but a lot of people didn't get that class, it seems like. It's pretty shocking.
Also, Christine, I'll say in Bennington, we've got a pretty solid working relationship with the NGOs that exist. But one of the things that strikes me in my work down here is how little happens down here conservation wise and how much of an advantage that's been in reestablishing our conservation district infrastructure, because we don't have an overpopulated pond of NGOs all fighting for very limited dollars. So we're able to work with them as people, because for the most part, our NGOs down here are, their boards are chapters with locals who are on those boards. And if they have staff, they're often locals. So we're able to work really well with them. But I don't think that's necessarily the case statewide. It's certainly not the case across the state line in Mass or in New York, it seems, at least not to the same degree. I was at a meeting with a bunch of New York environmental folks just last week, and they were shocked at what we're doing in Vermont and the level of collaboration that we have. I actually ended up talking to them about a fair amount about the local working group and our agricultural water quality partnerships and all of the interaction we're able to do, and it just kind of dumbstruck them. So I think Vermont in a way has this advantage in that everyone's really only two phone calls away, because we're such a small state that we're able to work across organizations a lot more effectively than in a massive state like Massachusetts or New York. There's just too many people in the system.
Yeah, and I would say that like in some states, conservation districts have a lot more visibility because they're a part of county government. In New England, we don't really have county government, so we're not. So that's part of why we're kind of like put into this other, you know, kind of invisible box. Your point about the environmental law space is important, and I think it should be taught. I mean, this is why for a couple of years I taught a class on conservation agriculture law at Vermont Law School after I graduated, because it was just missing from the curriculum. It just wasn't even there. It still isn't. So you know, well, if anyone
Christine,
wants to
develop curriculum. Down in your legal world, you're all grappling with what the reversal of Chevron means in the wider landscape of environmental work. And moving forward, having more robust local government and local environmental ordinances could be a key factor in maintaining or even expanding environmental protection that the feds no longer have a tool in their arsenal for. Our ordinance language just became more important than ever with the overturning of Chevron v. NRDC.
I think that's a great point. It just seems like there's space for innovation here in a way that makes your timing perfect. Jen, I'll contact you if I can't find your chart after the session. I'd really like to dig in and see what's happening in Massachusetts and see if I can, you know, make some connections that will help us get something going.
Absolutely. I'll put it in the chat now. We are trying to vet this now with every state. So before we really post it publicly, but you're welcome to use it. It's been vetted by us.
So. Super. Thank you.
Jen, are there any states you're trying to vet it in particular that you
will
need to
all
target?
Of them, really. Okay. The plan is to wondering. Kind of talk to everybody. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a big undertaking
with certain states that I'm working in, but mm-hmm. Let me know.
Thank you, Ernest. I see your notes. We'll definitely maybe, I have your email, I suppose, so we can definitely be in touch. Thank you for being here. Yes, there's, some states to really look at, of course, are Oregon and Washington and New Mexico. Then there's sort of this broader world of soil health law that goes sort of hand in hand, but it's a whole other survey that we could conduct. Any other thoughts or questions, comments?
Are you growing in all of the districts across Vermont? Hopefully, yes, 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 yes.
Oh, what was the question? Am I what with the districts across Vermont?
Hey, right now you are representing a certain area, so to speak, right? So
just my district, yeah, White River Conservation District.
Correct. Wouldn't it be cool if it was all across, or reached all across the state? Because
so, you know, we coordinate, yeah, all the districts coordinate with each other across Vermont, and we have our Natural Resource Conservation Council, and we also have a state association, so we have another conservation district person right here on the phone from Bennington County Conservation District. Yes, we're definitely in good touch with each other, which isn't for every state. You know, when I meet people from other states, like some of the Oregon districts, it's just so big that they're like, we'd never even see each other. And there's so many districts. So it's, yeah, unique collaboration opportunity being in a small place. And then, of course, we are also, as I mentioned, we're coordinating with the Caribbean Islands and their conservation districts. On this workforce development program. So I would say that's kind of looking to the future. We've been down to the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, but very specifically, we're going to be hosting 23 Climate Corps members, 12 in Vermont and 11 in the Virgin Islands, to try to develop this workforce of certified conservation planners and future, you know, professionals and future farmers. We have a current cohort of about 20 people going through it, and then we're adding this 23, and we really hope that it's going to expand and be a model for anywhere to start to get more technical service providers out here, which is really how we get the money out the door to the farmers. It's like the critical bottleneck in our current conservation delivery system. And that's why we see no farmers have any contracts, and it's July 7th. Just for the record, farmers still don't have contracts with the federal government for 2024. It's just a fact, a sad fact.
So Jen, how would you recommend, so like, for example, Jael and I both live in the Winooski Conservation District, you know, and here's the White River Conservation District training this workforce to try and distribute technical service providers, not just in the White River District, but, you know, all across the region and down to the Virgin Islands. How could we, where's the engagement point for us to lean into our own conservation district and try to work with them to get on board with that kind of training?
That's a great question. So anybody, we have our board meetings are open public meetings. And so they should be posted in a public place. And if they're not, you need to reach out to your district and prompt them to comply with open meeting law. Similarly with NRCC, they also need to comply with open meeting law and post their meetings. I currently don't know that they do that, but that's really important that we start to kind of push on to this infrastructure and like kind of, you know, swell it with energy so that, because it's just never been a priority, you know, and it's not funded very well. So it's really hard, like for me as a district manager to figure out, y'all know, but to figure out like, what do I even need to comply with, which is, you know, so yes, attend your local district board meeting, which happen monthly. That would be a place to learn. Those are open to the public. So that would probably be a great place to start.
Excellent. Thank you.
And of course, yeah, of course, asking about your local working group, but that's more of like an annual meeting.
And run for the board.
And then get involved and run for the board, yes. Which but in Vermont.
The 25 you know. Signatures run.
Jael for chair.
Great. So thank you all so much. Thanks for being here. Good to see you.
Thanks so much, everybody.
Have a great night.
Bye.